Welcome to the DisList Podcast. The DisList Podcast is part of the journal Disability in Libraries and Information Studies. I am the host, Jess Schomburg. Today, I'll be collecting an oral history from disabled librarian Shanu to hear their stories about working in libraries with disability.
I've been a librarian for about 15 years, and then just recently in the last year and a half, I've transitioned to library-adjacent work, where I work for a global nonprofit that does trainings and teaches librarians and other professionals about copyright and scholarly communication sorts of things.
Awesome. And before we get real started into things, do you have any other identities that impact your work that you are open to talking about during this interview?
Lots of them. Because all the data is going to be anonymized, I assume, right? Like, yeah, not going to be named.
You will be named. This is a oral history.
Oh, it is an oral history. Okay. Well, yeah, it's still fine. So I do identify as disabled in multiple ways, and we can talk more about what that means. I'm assuming you're going to have questions. But I also identify, I generally use the word queer. I am both bisexual and non-binary. But the word queer is a useful catch-all for me. So that's tends to be what I use. But you know, LGBTQIA+ or whatever acronym of choice is also fine. Beyond that, I'm white, and I was not born in America, but practically speaking was, and you know, I'm an American citizen by birth and I've lived here for almost my whole life. So, I have all the privileges that come along with that sort of thing also.
Our passports are blue, right? The fancy blue passport that gets you everywhere.
Yeah.
Yep.
I just wrote a book about passport privilege anyway.
That sounds really interesting, actually. But going back to identification and other things, if you would rather not be publicly identified, we can use a pseudonym for you.
Can I answer that question later?
Absolutely, because I can always edit this out, and we'll just talk around names. I probably won't address you by name anyway.
Yeah, I think it'll be fine. I didn't name my employer just in case, and I probably won't name previous employers, but can talk about them more generally. As sort of an aside, this was kind of a question I had for you. I know you're looking at, I think, if I remember this correctly, the experience of like library workers with disability. So I don't know if it's more helpful for me to focus on my past work specifically in libraries. Or if it's also helpful for me to include experiences at my current role that's not really, it's not a library, but I work with librarians in other ways.
You know, I think both because you are library adjacent,
yeah,
and also because you've transitioned from technically library work to technically not library work, comparing those experiences also, you know, is useful, I think. Because there are people, hopefully this will have listeners, but there might be people who are listening who are working in libraries who are like, I feel trapped here and I want to leave and I'm not sure how. And I think that's just really helpful to know. Also, there's always that grass is greener feeling, and just is it really? That's also helpful to know. Yeah. Yep.
In fact, as soon as you get on the other side, you're like, maybe the grass was greener over there. But when I was over there, the grass was greener over here.
It's the comparison glasses.
Right.
So, okay. Well, do you want to talk a little bit about what types of libraries you used to work in?
Sure. So I have worked in, I usually say, every type of library. Surely not every type, but many of them. So I started my career as a high school librarian and then transitioned to middle school. I was living in Virginia at the time. And then I moved to Pennsylvania, where I live now. And just the way the timing worked out with the school year, I didn't get a school job right away. And so kind of floundered around for a few months, figuring out what I wanted to do. And I figured I'd wait until the next school year. But in the meantime, I was hanging out at the library and had colleagues at the public library. And they said, hey, we're hiring. Are you interested? So I transitioned to public libraries then. After that, I briefly worked for the federal government at a special library just outside of Washington, D.C. I did a short-term contract there because I thought I might want to transition into academic libraries. And I thought that might be a nice way to kind of go from public libraries and get a different kind of experience. And it worked. So then I transitioned full-time to a small academic library near me, where I started in collections and then became the interim director. Then I went back to public libraries and was a director for a public library for a few years before moving to my current role, which again is more library adjacent, where I teach people cool stuff all day.
Awesome. Do you want to talk at all about the type of work you are doing at these different locations?
Oh, yeah. So, sorry, the cat came down to screen. I'm going to close that just in case you can hear her. Okay. So, right. When I started my career as a librarian, I was dead set on being a school librarian. I just kind of wanted to do everything. School librarians are often solo librarians, so you get to do a little bit of everything. I really liked that. And that's, I got my master's degree and specifically specialized in school librarianship. And then when I transitioned to public libraries, it was specifically as a cataloger. So I got really into cataloging and tech services for a while, but I've always kind of been a jack of all trades, generalist sort of person. So even when I was cataloging, I was the first person that they would call if they needed somebody to fill in on a desk somewhere or to fill in at a branch or to fill in another department. So I liked that. I was still early in my career. I got to do lots of different things and kind of learn what I wanted to do. But I really stayed primarily in cataloging and technical services for a long time. So when I went to the government, I became a government documents cataloger, and just did kind of other techie sorts of things as it came up, did a little bit of work on like their institutional repository, that sort of stuff. And then when I went to the academic library, again, I was at a very small institution. There were only about three or four of us. So I wore a lot of hats there too. So my title at first was collections management librarian, but I was essentially responsible for all of the purchasing, all of the budget, anywhere we spent money, but also managing all the student workers who were primarily working the front desk and doing sort of the frontline reference and circulation work. And then, yeah, I was just kind of running all of that stuff, which led naturally to becoming the interim director. So more formally running all of that stuff and actually getting to set the budget and not just spend the budget. Yeah, so I've always been, like, tech services feels like my home. I've always felt very comfortable with my cataloging colleagues. But I've also always been very comfortable kind of on both sides of that, you know, back of house, front of house divide. I think my preference is probably to spend more time in the back of house than the front of house, but I don't mind doing reference and instruction where necessary, or, you know, doing circulation and access services and those sorts of things. So I've kind of been all over the place.
Yeah. Yeah. And during, because you've had a number of different employers and responsibilities over your time. And also, I know, like, disability isn't necessarily like a static thing. But over the course of your time, how open were you about your disabilities at work?
So, I mean, I think in the early days of my career, I did not consider myself disabled, which is interesting because I had all of the same conditions that I have now. I don't think my health status was all that different back then, maybe a little bit, but I didn't really think of myself as disabled until kind of halfway through my career as I started getting more into academia and meeting other people and really thinking more critically about kind of where I fit. So I've always been, I'm a generally a pretty open person. So I've always been open about parts of my disabled life and disabled identity. I am not typically open about all of it at work. I can't think of anywhere that I've worked where I have disclosed, you know, I have a number of different conditions that I think all qualify as disabilities. And I don't think I've ever been in a workplace where I have disclosed all of them. I tend to focus on the ones that I think people will understand more. So like physical ones, right? So I'm diabetic. That's one I tell everybody about. I have no problems telling people I'm diabetic. And so that's always one of the first things that a new employer kind of finds out about me, because I'm like, well, if I pass out in the middle of a meeting, this is a thing you should know. It hasn't happened, but in case it does.
Yep.
Same. But yeah, other sorts of things like I also struggle with some mental health disorders. And I'm discovering still in the process of discovering some potential neurodivergence and what exactly that means somewhere on the autism spectrum and what that exactly entails for my life. Those are things I don't typically disclose in a workplace. Although I am becoming more comfortable, like if it came up, I don't know if I would hide it, but I'm just not very proactive about it.
So, and how have your, cause you've also been hired many times. Yay. So what have your different hiring experiences been like in terms of, your disability status, like whether you disclosed during the interview process ever requested accommodations?
So I don't think I've ever disclosed during the interview process. I almost consider it like a little bit of privilege in a way that like I have disabilities that are more hideable than some other folks that I know. So it's easy for me, you know, if there's something where I have low energy or something because of, you know, I can always just blame it on, oh, you know, I'm tired, or oh, I just didn't sleep well, or you know, when I need extra bathroom breaks or something, just I must have eaten something that disagreed with me a little bit. I can always just blame it on something that a non-disabled person will just kind of ignore and take as normal. So I think I've also been lucky in that, you know, I've never felt the need to ask for specific accommodations. Like the sorts of accommodations that are most helpful for me are things I can just sort of sneak in without having to make a formal request. Like, oh, I just need an extra bathroom break, or, oh, I just, you know, can I just sit down for a few minutes? So I'm usually pretty lucky that way. I'm also lucky in that I've never had the dreaded entire day nightmare interview scenario, which a lot of academics I know have had. All of my interviews have been more standard. I think the longest I've ever had is a couple hours. So usually, you know, even on my worst day, I can usually rally for a couple of hours and put on a good show and then go collapse in my car at the end of it.
Yeah. Yep. I think my interview for my current job was a day and a half, and that was a lot.
Yeah.
Yep.
I remember those. I had grad school interviews like way back in the day before I was a librarian. I remember those, and I'm very thankful I don't have those anymore.
Yeah. Cause it's, especially since you mentioned being diabetic, it's like the food aspects of that and the obligation to eat meals with your interviewing group is it can be a bit of a problem sometimes.
Yes. And sometimes they'll bring in like catered meals, or it's whatever the campus dining services provides. So you don't get a choice in, you know, oh, we're having lunch and here's what you have. And it may or may not be things I can actually eat. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So during your different positions, both within libraries and your current library adjacent position, what kinds of institutional or personal support structures have been available to you?
This is an interesting question. I have no idea if there have been institutional support measures available to me or not. Similar, like with the interview process, it's been the same. I haven't, in the workplace, I've never asked for accommodations. I've always just sort of been lucky enough to have a job where I can figure it out and make it work. And frankly, I think I've probably, my career has been sort of self-selected a little bit in that way, right? Like I deliberately don't apply for jobs where I know that I'm not going to be able to grab a snack whenever I need one or have access to a bathroom. This is actually one of the reasons. So I have a teaching certification, and when it was hard to find a school librarian job, I toyed with the idea of going back, becoming a classroom teacher. And I substitute taught for a while just to, you know, in between things. And even as a sub coming in for the day, that classroom teacher experience, you can't just step out of your class whenever you want to. You know, I talk to teachers all the time who tell me about, you know, they're very experienced at, you know, holding all their bodily functions for 8 hours until the end of the day when the kids are gone. And I was maybe able to do that when I was younger or before, I don't know. But I was like, no, I don't think this is not the career for me. Like, I'm not going to be able to be a classroom teacher because I need different. I have different sorts of needs. And there's probably a way to do it and request accommodations. But especially, I mean, this was 10, 15 years ago when I was thinking about these things. I certainly didn't know that accommodations were a thing I could ask for. And I certainly didn't know how. And it all seemed really difficult and hard and like probably a thing that would just get me fired somehow. Like, even if that's illegal, they'd find a way, right? There'd be some excuse. Oh, it's just not working out. So, you know, there's a very strong feeling of like, I just don't want to rock the boat. So I've always sort of leaned on like more informal supports and just kind of personal supports, you know, like rearranging my personal life to accommodate work. Scheduling doctor's appointments around work, scheduling procedures around times I know I'm not going to have to do really intensive sorts of things. So like if I, like right now, you know, next week I might be delivering a 4-hour long training. That's a long chunk of time. So there's going to be some prep I do in the few days before that to make sure I have enough energy, to make sure that, you know, all my ducks are in a row physically and mentally to prepare for that. So usually I end up finding, like, I've never really availed myself of HR either, which I guess is what you're supposed to do. Most of the places I've worked have either been so small they don't have HR, or there's like one person doing HR along with 12 other things, and I don't necessarily, like, sometimes that's not a person I like or want to confide in. So I think what I usually end up doing is finding like a trusted colleague who I can commiserate with and just sort of get gut checks like, hey, if I walk out in the middle of a meeting because I need to do X, Y, and Z, do you think anyone will care? You know, and they'll go, no, it's fine. And then I'll just do it. Or, you know, they'll say, I'll cover for you. I'll make up an excuse. That's like, great. So I end up using a lot more informal supports in that way. I think my current workplace would probably want to be the most accommodating if I needed accommodations. But I also, like, I don't think they would know how. I don't think they've actually ever experienced it. Like, I think they would, they're like nice people who would want to try to do the right thing, but wouldn't know how to do the right thing. And I'm just like kind of hoping I don't need accommodations because I also don't want to do the emotional labor of educating them about what the right thing is.
So I am guessing based on some of what you shared that you did not start this career knowing about the ADA, the legal protections it's supposed to provide, and your coverage under it. When did you start learning about that?
That's a good question. I don't think I started learning about the ADA. I certainly had no idea, like probably intellectually knew that there was something, the Americans with Disabilities Act was somehow a thing. But again, I didn't consider myself disabled, so it certainly wasn't a thing that applied to me. And so it wasn't relevant to my life. It was over in a box somewhere. And it was probably, honestly, it was library Twitter. Library Twitter is like, was the best. And this would have been when I was like in that public library cataloging, transitioning to government, to academia, is when I started meeting other librarians and meeting disabled library workers. And realizing, oh, wait a second, I have a lot of things in common with these people. And, you know, that's also around the time I started you know, I was diagnosed with diabetes later in life. So this is only a few years after I was diagnosed with diabetes and kind of figuring out how to manage that. Also finally starting to manage mental health troubles that had plagued me my whole, like, this is all kind of coming around the same time where I'm starting to, like, really just recognize and acknowledge in my own life and my personal life that I am a person who has needs that might be different from other people. And then all of a sudden, you know, people are using the word disabled and I'm thinking, oh, maybe this is a descriptor that also applies to me. And I remember at some point actually Googling the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA. And they have like a list of conditions that like 100% these qualify as ADA disabilities, and diabetes is on that list. And I hadn't really thought of diabetes as a disability before that. It's a chronic illness. I knew it was a thing I'm going to have forever and that I was going to manage my whole life around. But that was really, I was like, well, if the law defines it as a disability, maybe I should too. And that started to really change the way that I think about things.
So you've just prompted, you know, like go off on my own mental tangent about how, you know, we're socialized into our identities. Mm-hmm. And a legal standard that often feels really restrictive in practice is actually also how we find community.
Yeah, it was almost like, you know, even though I had never asked for accommodations, just like knowing I could, right? And like I could wave this piece of paper that like, you know, that I have like the full backing of the U.S. government for whatever that's worth. But that like if an employer denied me, I might have legal recourse, you know, that I could talk to a lawyer and like somebody that there's, you know, a system out there that would believe me that I do count under this thing. It's weird how that mattered, even though like sort of in my life and in general, I know that systems aren't usually helpful and don't matter. But I also like I tend to I can sometimes default to like sort of very rigid definitional thinking. And so like it felt very cool. I was like, well, there's a very clear definition for this. And so, boom, I meet the definition. Done. No more questions. Like it also fit in with that particular way that my brain works, where it just sort of clarified things. And it was like, okay, well, now I have a concrete, I can fit into a box finally, even though I don't like being in a box. On the other hand, the box provides a little bit of security and safety.
Yeah. Yeah. The box of validation. Yes.
Yeah. sorry, if I can just interject, that reminded me. I think that was a big part of it too, is honestly talking to folks like you, other folks that I met, again, library Twitter. I remember when I was just starting to use the word disabled for myself, being worried that like the disability community would not accept me, that I was not disabled enough because I don't look disabled or I didn't act disabled. I don't know what that means, but you know, these worries that like, well, these people, they have real problems and like my problems are like fake problems. And the disability community, at least the parts of it that I know, have been, you know, very warm and accepting and lovely. And I found out I have lots of things in common with these folks. And I was like, oh, this is okay. This is great. So this is an identity label that I can claim and feel comfortable with. So
you talked a little bit about your developing awareness and acceptance of your disability identity when you started transitioning more into academics. Have you found that there's more social support for academic librarians with disabilities than in school or public libraries? Or do you think that was just like a coincidence of timing?
I don't think it was a coincidence necessarily, although I'm going to have to think out loud a little bit about sort of why it might have. You know, I think there is something to the idea that certainly even without formal supports, like informally, the type of work that I was doing as an academic librarian was much easier to just sort of informally accommodate than the type of work I was doing even as a public librarian, right? Like if I'm assigned to a desk and I'm the only one at the desk, I can't necessarily leave the desk because there's a cash drawer or something there. I need to go find somebody to cover for me at the desk before I can walk away. Whereas in my academic library workplace, all of a sudden now I have my own office, which I had never had before. So now I can keep all sorts of supplies. I can stash snacks when, you know, I've got my own space. If I need to change a medical device or inject insulin, I have a door I can close. And now I have privacy where I can do that. I never had that before. And also, I think just in the academic environment, there's a little bit more awareness and acceptance of disability identity. And I guess what I mean by that is that, like, when I would talk to folks in, like, a school or public library environment, which I did, you know, I go back and I talk to those folks now even, and I'll mention that I'm disabled and I'll get responses like, oh, don't, you know, don't be so down on yourself, or, oh, don't, you know, don't say things like that. You're fine. Or, you know, oh, buck up, you know, something. And they mean well, right? But, like, there's a sense that, like, oh no, the only people, disabled people are somehow, you know, you can only be disabled if you are, like, very visibly somehow disabled. You know, if you're not in a wheelchair, it doesn't count. And I think because disability studies is, you know, an academic thing, I think there's enough academics who kind of have had at least some contact or some awareness of the idea that, like, oh, disability is actually a little broader than that. Disability as an identity can encompass more than just folks in wheelchairs. And so, I don't know exactly what it is, but I do think that change in environment really enabled this sort of change in everything else.
So this is a slightly different angle, still kind of related to your various experiences being hired in different sorts of libraries. As you were searching for jobs, or even trying to decide whether to stay at a job, how important were concerns about healthcare coverage or other socioeconomic concerns? How did that impact your job search process or your decision to stay or leave any place?
Hugely. It's one of the biggest factors that I think about when taking a job, is healthcare coverage specifically. So a couple examples. For a while, when I was transitioning into public libraries, I worked part-time instead of full-time, which I actually really enjoyed. I'd kind of love to go back to working part-time, but I don't, because part-time doesn't usually get healthcare coverage. And I need health insurance. At the time, I was lucky enough, I was married to somebody who had really good health insurance, and we could put me on that insurance. But it's a calculus I had to do, right? Like, if I had no other way, if I didn't have spousal insurance coverage, I would not have taken that part-time job. I would have had to look for something else. And even now, like, my spouse has different insurance coverage, and it's really expensive to put me on it. So it's actually really better if I stay employed full time so that I can have my own insurance coverage. But it's interesting. I have some younger friends who I'll talk to and just sort of give job interview advice, because I've done it a lot, because I've worked in a lot of places. And one of the things that I realize that I always do that other people do not always do is I certainly care about salary. You know, I need enough money to, you know, pay rent and buy food and buy drugs and all that other stuff. But I always ask for a copy of the benefits package before I accept a job. And sometimes I will have hiring managers who are surprised when I ask that. And I'm like, you might not be able to share everything with me. That's fine if there's stuff that's proprietary. Sorry if you can hear the cat. But just share whatever you can, because I just kind of want to be able to compare. And I've actually, you know, when I took my job as a public library director, I had 4 job offers on the table. And a lot of it came down to benefits. Who had the best health insurance coverage? Not only just, you know, the cheapest, but also as many disabled people are, I know which insurance companies are easier to work with and which ones aren't, because I spend hours on the phone with them all the time. I know which insurance companies cover the doctors that I like and which ones don't. So I want to make sure my good doctors are in network. And I will not take a job if their insurance coverage sucks. I will go look for something else. And not just that, but also things like PTO benefits. Like, I want to make sure that I'm getting adequate sick leave and that I have other paid time off so that I can go take care of myself when I need to take care of myself without taking a huge financial hit. That's a thing I think about all the time when I'm interviewing and applying for jobs. And that, again, I do feel like immensely fortunate that I sort of have that I have the ability to do that. You know, I think about friends and family all the time who are just kind of struggling to make ends meet and they have to take whatever job and they don't get to choose the one that has the good benefits. And I've been lucky that I get to choose the one that has the good benefits so far, knock on wood. But it's a thing that's like, I worry about it all the time in the back of my head. Like, oh, if I lose my current job, will I ever be able to get another job where I can get healthcare? Will I ever be able to get another job where I can afford stuff? Yeah, there's a lot of pressure there.
Yeah, for real. So I'm going to switch us a little bit, because I think this is a good place to move out to thinking about your disability advocacy work. I know that you have written in this area, believe you've spoken in this area. I know at least you used to be actively involved in library Twitter when that was still a thing. You may have other ways of doing disability advocacy that I am not yet aware of. But could you talk a little bit about what you've done and how you started getting involved in that?
Yeah, I think a lot of it, again, was library Twitter back in the day. You know, there was this random person on library Twitter, who I'm talking to right now, who was looking for, somebody to co-edit a journal issue about disability and librarianship. And I was early in my career and I wanted more experience doing that sort of thing, writing and publishing, wanted to see if it was for me. And so I just kind of dove in and, I don't do nearly as much disability advocacy as lots of other people do. Especially now it's, you know, when I was in academia, you know, it's expected that you'll publish on things and my department didn't care what I published about. So it was easy to write a few things about disability when I wanted to. Now my work is centered on things that are completely different. So I don't really get the time to do that as much as possible. Or as much as I was before. But I think a lot of my disability advocacy is mostly just in talking to other people about it. Kind of the same way I approach the way I do queer advocacy, which again, like I struggle calling myself an advocate because I don't feel like I do a whole lot. But I feel like what I do is not hide stuff from people. Again, I'm kind of an open book about a lot of things, and I especially love to be kind of the counterexample in the room. Like, I love to be, if I'm sitting at work and everybody's talking about how, you know, all those disabled people need things and isn't that weird and a good thing we don't have any of those here, I'm the person who goes, hi, you have one of those here. Surprise, you've been talking to one of those for years. We're all very reasonable people, actually. I think that's like, when I think about advocacy, I think about those sorts of things, where I tend to be the person, like, I'm not, you know, I'm married, I look like a woman and I am married to a man. So when I'm walking around town, people don't think I'm queer. And I don't use mobility devices or obvious, physical aids. So when I'm walking around town, I don't look disabled. So I try to, you know, when it comes up in conversation, I try to just kind of throw it out there and make it known that, like, hi, there's lots of us out there in the world, actually. There's way more of us than you think there are. You could easily be one of us at any time. Disability status changes so easily and so quickly. And we're all going to, you know, have needs at some point in our lives. We're all going to end up moving in and out of some level of disability at some point. And so I just kind of like to remind people of that fact. So I don't do any sort of formal, you know, I'm not like marching or, I don't know, doing any sort of like organized actions or anything. I'm just sort of like that annoying kid in the corner who's like, hey, wait a second, just please remember that people like me exist.
Yeah, I feel like being disabled in the workplace requires that as a survival skill in some ways. On a related topic, why do people with disabilities need advocates? Or why is it that you do feel that it's important for you to be that annoying person and speak up even if people get grumpy with you?
This is interesting. Because when you said, why do people with disabilities need advocates? I immediately pictured a non-disabled advocate. And I was like, you know what? I don't know if I need them. I don't know if that's what I need. Like, maybe, but take it or leave it. But then when you reframe the question, it's like, okay, why am I the person who speaks up? And it's like, you know, I don't know if maybe I feel almost a little more obligated. Like, I think it's easier for me in a lot of ways to speak up because of all the attendant privileges I have. Like, I'm white, so I already get access to lots of spaces that lots of other people don't. I live in a rural area in a nice house and make a nice income and have a nice passport. And all of my like financial needs are pretty much taken care of. So again, I have access to a lot of spaces that other people don't. And so I do kind of feel an obligation, although it's not a negative thing, but sort of a, you know, a responsibility. I've just always been that person who likes to defy expectations a little bit and to just make people question their assumptions a lot bit. So I think it's just important for people to understand that, and lots of people do, but just to kind of keep reminding them, keep it at the forefront of your mind that like there are just lots and lots and lots of different people in the world, and there's probably more alike about, you know, this ridiculous hellscape that we live in and these absurd meat sacks that we carry around that are constantly breaking down, and just like having that compassion for other people and just recognizing that, like, you know, we're all struggling in our own special ways, and let's just do what we can to like make it better, or to at least make it not worse. Yeah, I think especially with, you know, the way that I define disability being really broad, right? I think it's just a lot of people don't understand that like disability is not just tooling around in a wheelchair. Disability is not just whatever, you know, stereotype you have from whatever you saw in the movies or grew up with as a kid. And I think that's kind of the importance of advocacy is helping people realize that like disability is your neighbor. Disability is your family. Disability is you. Disability has been you, you know, like when you were 10 years old and you broke your leg and you walked around on crutches, like, congratulations, you got a little bit of a taste of what it is like to live with disability. And yours was temporary and, you know, you didn't have to use those crutches forever, but maybe now when you see somebody who's using crutches and uses them for the rest of their life, you'll have a little more understanding and a little more compassion for kind of what they're going through. Instead of just assuming that like, they're weird or annoying or whatever. So I think that kind of advocacy is helpful and important, just to kind of remind people that like, this is a thing that the real people deal with, and that you're going to have to deal with too eventually, you know, even if not for you, then for someone you love, and also probably for you. So the more we can kind of just come to terms with that and be comfortable with that, and I think the better off we are.
So some of what you talked about was related to like public perceptions of disability. And I'm thinking like we're in an information field, even with your library adjacentness, that's still information related field.
Oh, yeah.
So how, like, do you, this may be a question that you haven't thought of before, and take as much time as you need to think about it. But like, what parallels or areas of synchronicity do you see? I love throwing that word out because it's such an annoying phrase, but what areas of synchronicity do you see between LIS work and disability advocacy?
I don't know if this is a thing I've ever really thought about before. I think, so I've always approached information work and LIS work from a background of education, right? Like I became a librarian because I wanted to be a school librarian because I realized that I was really good at finding information and making connections and synthesizing stuff from lots of different sources and then helping other people do the same thing. And I was like, oh, I think that's kind of what librarians do sometimes. Maybe I should go to library school. And even when I was working in the back of the house and when I was cataloging, everything that I was doing, the choices that I was making about which terminology to use in this MARC record or how did I want this system to interpret the records and show up in the online catalog, I was thinking about, you know, how is this going to be useful for users, for patrons? And I think there's some parallels there in that, like, I see, to me, the disability advocacy stuff that I do anyway, or that I sort of naturally end up focusing on, is education-based. It's about, you know, teaching people that this is what disability is and, you know, this is how it works and it maybe isn't what you think it is. And isn't that fun? I love showing, you know, I always love learning things that are different than what I thought they were. And so I always love trying to teach other people, hey, maybe this thing is different than what you thought it was. And I think information work is very similar, at least in the way I used to approach it, that, you know, I always loved when, like, in the academic library, like a student would come up to me and say, you know, oh, there's no sources about this topic. I just can't do it. You know, my teacher assigned this topic and there's nothing. And I'm like, great. Like, let me show you there's actually stuff that's different than what you think it is, right? Like the way you search, let me show you a different way to search, or let me show you a different place to look that isn't what you, you know, would naturally assume. But like, you know, let's do a little bit of education. Let's kind of let's look for some stuff that is different than what you think. And even, you know, in the public library, if I have a patron that comes to the desk and they're, you know, I want information about X, Y, and Z, I'm often, you know, I'm very mindful about like misinformation and disinformation, like a lot of library workers are. And I was a public librarian in the midst of COVID and US election drama and all of that stuff, public library director. So I always loved when a patron would come to the desk with like a preconceived notion about something, like I want a book that proves X. And then, because I would always approach it from an angle of, okay, you know, we might be able to find you a book that proves X, but I also would like you to look at some books that prove Y, or that prove Z, or that prove A, B, and C. And, you know, just consider those, right? Like, just consider that there is a whole, like, realm of possibilities out there that aren't just the sort of information that you're used to. It doesn't always work, right? Like, not everybody wants to do that. But I kind of, you know, as I think about it, I kind of approach them in the same way, right? Like if you ask me for information, I will probably give you the information, but we'll also show you some information that might be useful, but that you might not have otherwise thought about. And the same thing, like if I hear people talking about disability, I'm probably going to crash in like the Kool-Aid man to the conversation and say, cool, disability, I agree, but hey, have you also considered this other thing that isn't maybe what you were thinking about or what you would naturally consider? And just try to expand people's thinking in that way. And I think that's a big part of that's what I always loved about LIS work. And even the training work I do now is that, you know, we get to expand people's thinking in the best case scenarios, right? Like we get to watch people grow and kind of meet their goals. And I used to say, the library is there to help people live their best lives. That was my tagline as a library director. And I think, you know, advocacy, disability advocacy, queer advocacy, these sorts of things also are kind of helping people live their best lives, helping queer people be more accepted, helping disabled people be more accepted, but also helping non-queer and non-disabled people just realize that, like, the world is still great and, like, that they have lots in common with people who aren't like them and that that's okay, too.
Well, thank you for that, answering that on the spot with, yeah. So, this is kind of, we're kind of going towards the wrapping up part. So is there anything else that you want to talk about today, or are there questions that you thought I would ask or think I should ask that I didn't bring up?
think we touched on this a little bit, but I'd love to just sort of ramble on briefly, a little bit more about sort of disability stigma.
Yeah,
And
please
especially,
do.
and this is a thing that, like, you know, I've been trying to write a little bit about, and I'm still not really sure what I think about it. But just there's this notion that I have from my own life, right? Like, it's always been so much easier for me to talk about diabetes in the workplace, and not talk about my anxiety or my depression. And especially since we were just talking about advocacy, you know, I don't really have well-formed thoughts about it, but I'd love to kind of explore more about why, as a society, we are more comfortable talking about some disabilities versus others, or why I at least feel that I will be more accepted if I talk to people about diabetes. They will go, yeah, okay, I understand. Whereas if I talk to people about depression, they're going to shy away. They're going to back away from the conversation. They're going to look a little uncomfortable. Why, for example, it feels totally fine to like bring up diabetes in a work meeting, like, oh, I need to step out because my blood sugar is low. But it would not feel fine at all to step away from a work meeting because I'm like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm having suicidal thoughts right now. I just need to go take a minute. Like, that feels like it would derail the whole meeting and everyone would be like, oh my gosh, I think they would. But like, that experience is just as real to me as my low blood sugar. I mean, it's not a thing that happens very often. I mean, even talking to you, I feel the need to qualify it, right? Like, don't worry about me, I'm okay. But this is what life with depression is like sometimes, right? Like, your brain tells you things that aren't true. Your brain tells you things. And there's this weirdness that, like, yeah, why is one of those socially acceptable to talk about in the middle of a business meeting and one of them is not? I don't know. I just know it is.
Why is one of them socially acceptable to talk about on a social media platform and one is not? Same ones, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, I
Well,
was
yeah.
recently talking, and I don't know if this is the reason, but I was recently talking with some people about this, like the topic of disclosing SI, the suicidal ideation. And like, it took me a long time to disclose that to therapists because they have that obligation to report. And it's like, I do not want to be involuntarily committed. I am complicated
Exactly.
enough to keep alive in my home. Being in an institution would be very dangerous for me. It's like I'm having the ideation. Like if I really wanted to make it happen, getting institutionalized is the best way forward. That was kind of a joke, but
No.
a real dark one.
I don't know, but I kind of felt it, right? Like, I kind of agree.
It's like getting to the point where I could start, where I could figure out a script to disclose to my therapist so that I could talk with them about it and get coping skills that I needed to better survive it. It's like that in itself is so hard. Whereas like, even though there was a lot of shaming in my childhood around disclosing blood sugars not being where they should be, it's still less, there's still less of a likelihood of being incarcerated if I did that. And so it's like, how much of this is people are uncomfortable, so we create rules that actually really, really prevent people from disclosing? Or do the rules really make people feel unsafe, like chicken egg? I don't know. But there's also the American fear of mortality and inability to socially process grief, inabilities to acknowledge grief or mourning. There's also like, what role does disgust play in it? That's sort of those, because I know, talking with people who have, who need assistance in bathing themselves, in clothing themselves, in peeing or pooping, or who need colostomy bags, or any of like the liquids.
Oh yeah, no, people, bodily fluids are a whole thing.
Yeah.
I've got stories for days. No, I was just reading an article about, you know, the way America sort of treats death is very different from lots of other countries and lots of other cultures. And we kind of hide it away and put it all behind closed doors. And yeah. But yeah, it's very interesting to me. I don't know. You know, talking about queer advocacy, to go back to that for a second, I guess there are some things, some like, you know, so I mentioned suicidal ideation. I am a suicide survivor. It's a thing I talk about sometimes, but again, I'm really hesitant to bring up just until I know somebody really well, because people have very strange reactions. But I'm also I'm a certified crisis counselor with Crisis Text Line. So I talk to a lot of people who are in a very heated moment, trying to get them to a calmer moment. And I just went through QPR training, which is a suicide prevention technique called question, persuade, and refer. Where it just gets people more comfortable talking about, just people won't even say the word, right? And it just gets people more comfortable talking about it, because, you know, we've got so much research that shows that talking about suicide does not make somebody go and attempt suicide. Talking about suicide is not the thing that causes it. In fact, it usually prevents it. Most people just want to be able to unburden themselves of these thoughts that they feel that they can't share. And yeah, I mean, it was years before I would even ask for help. I had a similar experience to you where I was like, well, I can't even tell a doctor about this because they'll just blow it all out of proportion, right? Like if I tell a colleague, they'll just call 911 and now I'm going to get involuntarily committed, even though that's, you know, this is not an emergency. I am fine. And I worried that even a doctor, you know, who didn't know very much or wasn't sensitive to the topic would just, they'd hear that word and just automatically, you know, you're getting locked away for however long. And that nothing I said or did after that would matter. And I don't have, you know, like when I go to the endocrinologist and my A1C is way too high, I don't have the sense that they're going to stick me in a hospital bed and not let me go home for the next 3 days. But I do have that sense, you know, there's that fear with other sorts of conditions like, like depression and anxiety. It's very strange to me. Yeah, I don't know. I think society is moving forward, is changing a little bit in this respect. You know, the fact that I can have this conversation with you is something I don't think I would have done 20 years ago. But yeah, I don't know. I had another thought and I think it's gone now. So I talk too much. I know we're almost at time.
No, you are totally fine. So we're going to end with hopefully an easy, fun, light question. JJ told me I need to add something fun because it's like not my skill set.
Same. Thank goodness for JJ.
So this final question, are there any books or shows or games that you're really excited about right now?
I was like, I feel like I spend all of my time reading books and watching shows and playing games. And then I'm put on the spot to ask to name one. And I'm like,
what is your number one favorite book of all time? Man. Yeah.
I watch a lot of trash TV. And just like I like to advocate for people to just not be ashamed of their identities, I like to advocate for people to not be ashamed of liking the things that they like. I watch a junk reality television. I just went to see RuPaul's Drag Race live. RuPaul, terribly problematic in many ways. Drag Race, so formulaic, such a boring show. I love it anyway. I don't care. Stuff is, you know, they do fun and pretty songs and dances and they wear fun clothes and it's lots of bright colors and it's lots of fun things. So yeah, that's probably like, I've been binge watching a lot of Drag Race recently. That's probably the thing I'm really into right now. There have been some disabled queens on Drag Race. Oh. Evie Oddly is one of my favorite drag queens. I got to meet her in person a few weeks ago at a book signing. And she has Ehlers-Danlos syndrome and was very open about that on the show and in her career. So it's cool that like, all of your heroes are problematic. Everything's problematic in its own special little way. But we can find, you know, there's also some good things there. So.
Yeah. People are complicated. Absolutely. Yeah, that sounds great. And being able to, like, publicly disclose EDS as an entertainer.
Yeah.
What amazing. It's just like thinking, like just blah, 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 words I can't speak. But what an amazing thing for that performer to feel comfortable enough and proud enough and self-possessed enough to just be like, yep.
Yeah, it was interesting because she's the hypermobility type. So there's like, she can incorporate it into her act sometimes, right? Like there are some flexible positions that she can do that other people necessarily can't, or not, yeah, that other people maybe can't. But at the same time, you know, in TV, it's always like in a confessional, it's very dramatic. But then very candidly, she was like, I mean, yeah, I can do some of this stuff, but it takes a lot out of me. It takes a very physical toll. It takes a very intense physical toll. And I'm very mindful of the fact that like my body will not be able to do these things forever.
Yep.
And I have to think about this all the time. And I thought that again, like I just sharing stories, I think, is one of the most powerful advocacy tools we have. So I'm really excited to see that.
Thank you all for listening to this podcast. I was delighted to have the opportunity to talk with Shanu and learn more about how they have navigated different library and library-adjacent jobs with disabilities. Show notes with links to more information about some of the ideas we talked about are provided on the DisList Journal website, along with a transcript of this recording.